This is the Civil Judiciary Committee. Counsel, do you have a record of where Mr. Ekstrom is on time?
Mr. Ekstrom has used up a minute and 40 seconds.
All right, just in fairness. That leaves 3 minutes and 20.
That's correct.
Okay, Mr. Ekstrom, welcome back. Other members will be coming in. We'll go ahead and get started.
Is there a quorum requirement?
No, we're in a public hearing phase right now. Sitting as a subcommittee. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, as I was saying, I was trying to illustrate by way of a short story that these two towns in the mountain area in the Wild West were connected by a stage line. It was a vital connection between the two towns. The stage company needed a driver for their line, and they put out a poster, and at the appointed hour, the applicants lined up on the street, and as they were lined up, the representative of the stage line came out and said to each one of them, "Now, you know, men, we need the best driver we can find. The stage is very important to us. It's important to the passengers. The cargo we carry is valuable. I'm going to ask you a question. The most treacherous part of the route that the stage traverses is the sheer wall up one side and sheer wall down the other side, and it's quite narrow, and we need a man who can not only keep the stage on schedule but safely cover that bit of territory." And so he asked the first man in line, "Sir, if you were to drive our stage, how close would you be able to get to the edge and still feel like you had complete control?" And he said, "I could get within a foot or so, 16 inches a foot, and I'd have complete control. I've had experience with horses and stages before." And he proceeded on down the line asking each man the same question. Each man proceeded to declare that he could get closer to the edge, to the point where number 7 and 8 were hanging a wheel over the edge and still having complete control, or horse hoof or two over the edge, and number 9, I just won't bother telling you how many risks he was willing to take, and still said he'd have complete control. And the last man, you wonder what was left for him. And he looked at the representative of the stage line and said, "Sir, I guess I have a little different outlook on the issue. It's not how close to the edge I could get where I'd feel like I had the most control. It's how far away from the edge I could stay. And that's where I'd be most comfortable with your stage and the horses and the passengers." And by sharing the story with you, I'd like to just state something that maybe we agree upon, that the society we live in today, that we maybe recognize that in many ways we are on a precipice, that relationships between ourselves and between ourselves and our Creator are frayed and strained and tenuous. This particular bill, H.J.R. 29, speaks to a very important, fundamental foundation of society, the man-woman relationship and marriage. And I would like to ask each one of you to consider, if it isn't really, how far away from the edge we can stay, where safety is to be found in the decision that you will make as you vote, whether redefining a relationship that through history and in nature has always been the norm and the standard for human society, if maybe you wouldn't choose to recognize that safety says that we should protect and not tamper with that relationship. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ekstrom. Other questions? Ferris.
I have a question.
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Wall.
Thank you. I apologize. I was out of the room when other questions were asked, so this may have been asked before. But, you know, I defend to the death your right to have whatever relationship that you think is safe or that you want, and don't have any particular problem with a definition of marriage as a man and woman. My problem is with cutting out benefits from people. So I will ask you the same question that I asked the good Reverend Probst, do you have any objection to ordinary garden variety insurance benefits or other benefits accruing to someone's partner if they are not married, whether or not that partner's same sex or different sex?
Fairness is always to be aimed at, and in fact, I do in my daily affairs, and again, I'll say I'm just here as a citizen. I'm not uh-huh. representing a group, or I'm not a pastor or a social scientist. I'm just a citizen, and I'm so thankful for the opportunity. But fairness, of course, is essential, and the one who would ignore fairness issues, it's reckless. However, I think in this matter of marriage that society should, and this is my opinion, society should be willing to encourage the man and the woman in marriage, raising children, recognizing that in that institution the future of society lies, that it's a historical norm, that no society has ever survived who has departed at length from that, depriving people of their due benefits. No, I'm not in favor of that at all.
Okay, good. Now, you can define marriage however you wish. As I said before, you know, anybody can, and any society is going to have a societal definition of marriage, because it's going to, whatever it is, it's going to be a community sanctioning a union between two people, hopefully two people, limit that. But would you object to a definition of family as being non-related people?
I'm going to have to just say that in as much as my understanding of my life and of right and wrong is derived from the Bible, being a Christian and trying to actually implement what I read and study in the scriptures in my daily life, I don't believe that we can safely promote and normalize homosexual relationships in the same way that we do for a man and a wife relationship. Is that an answer to your question?
Well, thank you, follow up. I suppose so, but I guess then I must redefine my position as marriage might, you know, of course it's between a man and a woman, but maybe there can be other relationships that shouldn't be, I mean, family relationships, other kinds of relationships that, you know, people should be allowed to have. People do have. It's reality. But thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Barris, welcome to you, sir.
Chairman Southerly and the renowned and overworked committee. thank you for bringing this important issue, you know, into the people and citizens of the state of Oregon. I guess my concerns are that...
I'm sorry, if you could give your name for the record, Mr.
Oh, Barris. Exactly. My name is Lou Barris, Executive Director of Christian Coalition. My concern is about our Judeo-Christian heritage, and our country was built, you know, upon that. And it's brought freedom to all classes of people. And as I look at other countries, other religions around the world, do they have the freedom that we have here in the United States? When I look at India, some of the Pakistan, some of the countries, and they are, quote, a religious nation. Do they allow all citizens to have the freedom that we have? And so I just cherish our Judeo-Christian heritage. And as we go back to our founding fathers, the wisdom that they have had to give us this form of government is unbelievable. And I think it was a wisdom from God. When I went to the nation's capital, you see all the people there from Washington to Franklin and so forth, and they have the Constitution and the Bible draped together, and some of the principles, like the three forms of the legislative, We have the judicial. We have the executive. That came out of Numbers, right out of the Bible. So a lot of these principles came right out of, you know, God's word. So I'm concerned that we might become the first state to recognize same-sex marriage. And I have four daughters, 11 grandchildren, and I feel personally responsible for my grandchildren. I think having a male figure into the home is so important. And I think as we see a lot of the things going on in school right now, the killings and so forth, I think I have put the responsibility on men as males, that we have caused a lot of this responsibility. And it's not the women, but it's we as males have negated our responsibility to our family. And I believe this is why we're in the position we are. And I just want to encourage you to pass a vote and pass H.A.R. 29. And I just have to commend you of looking ahead for some of the problems that can assault, you know, our way of life. So I want to thank Chairman Southerly and the committee for your work.
Representative Lowe and Representative Water, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Barris.
Yes, we have talked before, haven't we?
Yeah, it's good to see you again. How are you?
Great.
I have a question for you there today, sir. And that is the same one that I've had for Reverend Probst and this gentleman here, and that is, let me tell you my focus of it. I'm kind of unhappy and anxious that other industries in this state are using, you know, stirring up the churches and some of the groups, you know, limit their exposure on giving benefits to people. I'm angry about that. I'm a little anxious about that. I don't think it makes good. It just stirs people up and it denies people something that they've paid for and that they should have a right to, I think. So I'm wondering what your feeling is about whether or not insurance benefits and basic benefits should be denied to a partner, an adult partner that you're living with, married, unmarried, same sex or not. What do you think?
Maybe I don't understand this bill. I understand that this bill doesn't cut out any insurance.
Actually, this bill does, and that's the whole reason. It's just in my opinion.
It's a choice of the people of that area, I understand, to every area, like the city of Portland.
It's my understanding, follow-up. There's two parts to this bill. And the first part is, hey, you don't get benefits. And the second part is a marriage will consist of a man and a union, a man and a woman in union only.
Okay.
There's two parts there. I would like the debate to be separate on both parts.
Well, if I may interject, I think it may be a matter of semantics. The resolution itself, I don't think eliminates specifically benefits. What it eliminates is a constitutional underpinning for the provision of benefits. Mm-hmm. This bill passes, right, and the next day, benefits don't go away.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman, but did I not read, no provision of this Constitution requires granting of marriage licenses or the rights or benefits of marriage to unmarried individuals.
I don't see it's taking it away. It's required. So, you know, maybe understanding the bill, I don't know, it looks like maybe everybody's understanding
it. I think it's an unholy... An unholy union of the word benefits and marriage, if you pardon the pun.
Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry, Representative Walker was next in the queue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Barris, I have a copy of your memo or letter that you sent to us, and there's a couple of things I just really need to talk to you about. They're a little inflammatory. The first one you say is, as a result of this decision, the will of the people has been usurped by three liberal judges. These judges appear to possess little respect for the right of the people to make the laws we live under. I have a real hard time understanding why the judges have little respect for the laws we live under and why you think the will of the people has been usurped here. Could you sort of enlighten me there?
It'll probably take maybe a half an hour. We could discuss that later, but just to give you a follow-up. I think it's been said here that we're the only, this is the only state in the union that has passed the decision of the Tanner decision versus OHSU. So that they usurped going the far edge, in my belief, in my opinion, of some of the laws, because we do not have any other laws in any other state in the union that like this.
Okay, all right, we're going to disagree on that because I don't think the people have said that they don't want these laws. Secondly, you say it is now clear that homosexuals will use the Tanner case to bring suit to have Oregon's marriage law declared unconstitutional for denying equal protection of the laws to homosexuals. How is that made clear to you? Have the homosexual community come forward to you and said, boy, we're going to put an initiative petition on the ballot and the Constitution?
No, I think, was there something today that the Attorney General has mentioned about the IRS? Is that one of the starting, you know, it's like Mr. Ekstrom said, we're living on the edge. It's going to be a tax thing. We have gotten to a far, what I believe, in the last 40 or 50 years, because I'm a little bit older than you are, Representative Walker, and I see erosion. You know, when I was a teenager in the 50s, I see that we didn't have to lock our homes. We knew all our neighbors. You were going down that road. This is a deterioration, I believe, of our society.
Okay,
and
so you just want to head them off at the pass before they make
no,
any
no, absolutely. I'll tell you some personal experience. I have a cousin that was a homosexual and he died of AIDS. His life was cut short.
Well, Mr. Barrister, a lot of people die of AIDS that are not homosexual. So that conversation ends.
Representative, I want to get away from a conversation that we're all listening to. Let's keep this back and forth. Protocol. Representative Witt, I think you're next.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to make sure that everybody understood that this bill does not deny benefits to anybody. All it says is that benefits are not required and that it would be the decision through the appropriate body to determine if tax dollars are going to be used for benefits or not.
Representative Wardwell.
excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to respond and ask a question to what was read from, I guess, I don't have a copy of your letter, but it said something about the will of the people. So my question to you of, has not the Christian Coalition or like organization twice brought to the people of this state initiatives that were turned down that had to do with homosexuality?
For your information, that was not Christian Coalition.
Okay.
That was Oregon Citizens Alliance, and that was not Christian Coalition.
I know your name was brought up in that context. But that brings into question what the will of the people really is, don't you think?
No, this is why I think it should go out to the will of the people, that HJR 29 should go out to the will of the people to vote. I understand it will go out, if it's passed, to the will of the people.
And Mr. Chair,
yes,
one comment I'd like to make, and I think I can make it, because I certainly am as old as you are, and you talked about the 50s and the glorious 50s. Well, let me just remind you, we had slavery. Indentured servitude, I guess you could say, of women in the 50s. We did not have equal rights of people of color in the 50s. So the 50s aren't quite as glorious.
Well, I think the people in the 50s, maybe including yourself and myself, worked towards of changing that.
Okay. I promise to be very sure.
You don't trust me, do you? Because, well, I'm as old as you guys are, too.
You don't look it, huh?
I owe it to Lady Claire Albert. Thank you. I'm an honest lawyer.
And now after this commercial break.
I'm worth it. I remember the 50s, too. And I remember couples in our neighborhood. Interestingly enough, this was in Virginia, and on the same block there was a couple of gentlemen bachelors, confirmed old bachelors, and likely to remain so. And they lived in a house. Nobody thought anything of it. It wasn't anything on anybody's radar screen. And there was a couple of lovely, lovely adult women, mature, adult retirement age women. They were traveling companions. They shared expenses. They shared their house, and they shared their lives, and they shared everything, I would imagine. Back in the 50s, nobody ever got upset or even didn't even cross anybody's minds that there might be a sexual element to their relationship. To this day, I doubt that there was. But under those circumstances, do you think they ought to be denied partnership benefits?
Well, I understand that even that...
I mean, when I get old, I might want to live with a one of my girlfriends. I mean, I'm happily married now. I've been so for a really long time. I think heterosexual, but I'd rather than fight the toilet seat wars with a male, I'd rather, you know, maybe share expenses with a woman. So why can't I have partnership benefits?
And just lift the lid and be all right. No.
I can't believe I'm having this conversation.
Frankly, I can't either.
I apologize.
Was there a question in there?
Yeah. The question is, why would you want to deny anybody partnership benefits?
I mean,
it's not ours to ask whether or not they're having sex.
I think you might be right. You might expand this because I think that we have a mother and a daughter living together, or a son and a mother, that maybe they should expand that to have benefits for them. I think that would be good. That's a good idea. Maybe you ought to make a change, Representative Lowe, on that.
Well,
expand that to.
I would think that Christ's disciples were a kind of a family too, and I would think that you can have unrelated people in a family.
I think maybe you ought to expand the benefits. I would be for that.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much for that enlightening exchange. Mr. Barris and Mr. Ekstrom, thank you for coming forward. Let's go on with have Dave Fedanke, Professor Dom Vetri, and former State Representative George Eamy.
Mr. Chair, coming up, I would just like to call to attention the committee, and I hope everybody got a copy of it, a letter from Candace Steele, and I think it's pretty self-explanatory, but Candace has been in the forefront of the movement for equal rights for gay and lesbians, and her husband, both her and her husband were, and he was tragically killed last year, and so she is not up here. She was here in the 97 session when we had a similar type bill and gave very telling testimony. So I would like that you all be sure and read her letter.
Okay, thank you. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, David Fedanke, Executive Director, ACLU of Oregon. I put together a little packet for the committee's benefit. I hope we'll put HR 29 in historical perspective. The purpose of HR 29, as I understand it, is to make an exception to Article 1, Section 20, which was the constitutional provision that was interpreted by the Court of Appeals in Tanner versus OHSU. You will see the current language of Article 1, Section 20 in the original version of HJR 29, which I assume you all have in your packets. No law shall be passed granting to any citizen or class of citizens privileges or immunities which upon the same terms shall not equally belong to all citizens. Now that provision in our State Bill of Rights, which has been in our State Bill of Rights since the drafting of the Oregon Constitution in 1857, I think says very clearly that no group of citizens in the state of Oregon is entitled to any special rights. It seems to me to be a very simple statement, a statement that we should be proud of in terms of our Oregon government. Unfortunately, the Oregon history is that that provision did not mean what it said in the early years of our state. Because at the same time that The drafters of the Oregon Bill of Rights wrote that language. They also came up with language that I have passed out to you in Article 1, Sections 31 and 35. And Article 1, Section 35 is probably best known by anyone who has studied a little bit of Oregon history, because it was put up to a vote of the people as a separate issue. The framers of the Oregon Constitution couldn't decide what to do about slavery, and say they put two questions to the people. One, shall there be slavery in Oregon? And two, if there should not be slavery, should we bar free Negroes and mulattoes from immigrating to the new state of Oregon? And the voters chose to prohibit slavery, but to also ban Negroes and mulattoes from immigrating to the state of Oregon. And in Section 31, a lesser-known cousin of that provision, there was protection for future citizens of the state of Oregon, but only those who were white foreigners. So foreigners who came to Oregon who were of color were not granted the same privileges and immunities under the Oregon Constitution originally. And there was a third provision, which shows up on the next page, in the suffrage and elections portion of the Constitution, Article 2, Section 6, which specifically prohibited the right, denied the right to vote for Negroes, Chinamen, and mulattoes. Now, those provisions fairly quickly were overcome by the politics of the Civil War. And following the Civil War and the abolition of slavery nationwide, we saw the adoption of the post-Civil War amendments at the federal level, the 13th Amendment, which prohibited slavery, the 14th Amendment, which guaranteed equal protection and privileges and immunities under law, and the 15th Amendment, which guaranteed the right of non-white male citizens to vote. Now, Oregon had a very checkered history on those provisions as well, and as you'll see from the material I passed out, the Oregon legislature had no problem ratifying the 13th Amendment prohibiting slavery, abolishing slavery. The 14th Amendment was initially ratified in 1866, but that ratification was rescinded by SJR 4 in 1868. And the 15th Amendment was not only not ratified, it was rejected by the Oregon legislature in 1870. So, and my major point today is that these provisions remained in our Constitution. The first three provisions I've pointed out from our original Oregon Constitution remained in our Constitution for many, many years. And we did not, as a state, finally ratify the 15th Amendment granting the right of non-white citizens to vote until 1959. And what I believe Article 1, Section 20 does is give every Oregonian the right to argue before their government that their rights as citizens should not be denied on an unequal, discriminatory basis. What HJR 29 will effectively do is say to one class of citizens, this is a promise that all citizens have in the state of Oregon except the group to which you belong, because you will from henceforth be permanently in our state second-class citizens under our Constitution. That will take us back down the road of enshrining discrimination in our Constitution and lead us back down a path that I think most of us had hoped was history in this state, not current events. I strongly urge you to oppose H.J.R. 29.
Thank you, Mr. Fidanza. Other questions? Professor.
Good afternoon, Chair Shetterly and committee members. I'm Dominic Vetri, and for identification purposes, I am a professor of law at the University of Oregon, but today I'm speaking in my individual capacity. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify. I recommend against adoption of H.J.R. 29. As a law professor and as a gay man that has been in a committed relationship for more than 20 years, I urge you to reject the attempt to place a minority's rights to equal protection of the laws on the ballot. We have gone through that process at the whim of an organization dedicated to a biased view of gay men and lesbians several times in recent years. This will be the first time in contemporary history, as Mr. Fidanza's testimony indicates, that the Oregon legislature would seek to place a minority's rights before the public for approval. Each of you as legislators have an obligation to determine whether H.J.R. 29 is constitutional and whether it is wise public policy. Essentially, I'm going to try to be briefer than my written portion of my remarks, but I want to make essentially three points. One is that I think that H.J.R. 29 is unconstitutional. Two, I think that the resolution will do nothing to benefit heterosexual couple marriages and will do great harm to gay and lesbian people and their families. And thirdly, I think that the provision in H.J.R. 29 that has to do with excluding rights and benefits has no place in the provision whatsoever. If the concern is with marriage, then I fail to see what the connection is between the provision that excludes rights and benefits. Just my understanding of history is that if you go back to the Middle Ages, marriage essentially was contractual. People got together, maybe they had a private ceremony before their family or whatever, and the church was not involved. Over a period of time, the Catholic Church, which was the dominant religion at that time, wanted to assert its control and its influence and began to require that commitment ceremonies be held before priests and be sanctioned by the church. And that practice began to be developed. Eventually, when you get in England with the establishment of a state religion, we ended up with reincorporating marriage back into civil law, and this is the source of the confusion that the civil law embodied two aspects: one, the civil component of law, and secondly, the religious aspect of it. We probably would do well to separate those two out if we could, and let marriage be treated by religious communities as they see fit, and have another name for the commitment relationship that people have that the law feels a need to pass legislation and to have rules and policies with regard to. If you think about the two examples that we've had before us today, one was the Tanner decision involving employment benefits, and the other is the taxation issue that Dave Schuman testified about. Neither one of those are dealing with the religious component of marriage. Both of them are dealing with the civil component of marriage. And so I think it's important to try and separate those two out. Equal protection of the laws is a fundamental part of our constitutional heritage. It guarantees that no true class can be singled out for disparate treatment without substantial reasons. Discrimination for its own sake, based on ancient prejudices, cannot suffice to create a caste system in our society. As a nation and a state, we pride ourselves on this basic human right. Indeed, by disallowing such an unequal treatment, we define ourselves as a people. The founders of Oregon's Constitution had such faith in the use of reason that they built in notions of equal privileges and immunities along with democratic principles as corollaries of one another. Equal protection principles have a long history. They were developed over time in a careful and prudent manner. In sum, a denial of equal protection exists if the difference in treatment between classes is premised on prejudice and not on substantial reasons. Classifications like race, gender, ethnicity, and religion are examples of groups that over time have come to be determined to be protected by equal protection principles. Just as each of the foregoing groups have had a long history of discriminatory treatment in law and a gradual recognition of the inappropriateness of such treatment through a case-by-case analysis and progression, we are now witnessing that slow progress to equality of treatment in dealing with sexual orientation discrimination. Carving out exceptions to equal protection is a dangerous business, and unworthy of a society that idealizes equal protection. Certainly we agree that we should not have amended our constitutions when the courts held women entitled to equal protection under the law, nor should we have done so when the courts did the same for religious and ethnic minorities. Why is it thought necessary to do so now? HJR 29 violates the minimum requirement that all legislation must have. It lacks a legitimate state purpose. Simply put, the function of 29 is to amend the Privileges and Immunities Clause to exclude gay men and lesbians from civil rights protection that the Constitution may otherwise require. The resolution's effect is to treat gay and lesbian citizens differently than other citizens as a matter of law, solely because of old stereotypes and prejudices. We have heard over and over again the claim that gay people do not need civil rights statutory protection because they have the same constitutional protections as other citizens. Just when the Oregon courts get around, as they did in Tanner, to perhaps conclude that gays do have protection under the Equal Protection Clause, we now see a movement to amend the state constitution to deny us such rights. In 1996,
Professor, time is up. If we can get this wrapped up, and you know,
in the written testimony that I've submitted, I also allude to the Romer versus Evans decision, which is, the Supreme Court decided in 1996, which concluded that laws that are premised on animus or prejudice against gay and lesbian people will not be upheld, and the Colorado initiative was found unconstitutional. I think that one key thing here is we've become accustomed to dealing with rights and responsibilities in the shorthand of marriage, when the concern should properly be with the relationship commitment, straight or gay. The things like the employment benefits issue, the intestacy laws, et cetera, it seemed to me demonstrate the error of the ways that we have gone down, where we're looking to marriage only as a shorthand for what in effect is really what we're concerned with. Is there a loving, caring relationship there that warrants maybe a concern about insurance benefits, or a concern about wrongful death benefits, or a concern about intestacy law protection? I think this subject is controversial, and the extension of civil liberties has never been easy for any minority group. And I hope that each of you as legislators will look to your responsibility to uphold the Constitution and think about equal protection principles before you deal with this measure. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Professor Vetri? I want to say, for committee members who may not know, Professor Vetri is also a colleague and member of the Oregon Law Commission bills from which we've seen this session and passed out. So,
well, I, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to say that when I was an undergraduate at the U of O, I was a work-study student at the law school from 74 to 78, at which time you were there with Mrs. Ackerman. So just want to say hello.
Hi. Okay. Mr. Amy.
Thank you, Chair.
I sort of expect to see you over there. I'm used to the perspective. Welcome back.
Thank you, Chair Shetterly, and members of the committee who are remaining. And having sat on that side of the table for many times, I understand what you're going through right now. For the record, my name is George Amy. I am presently the executive director of an organization known as Compassion in Dying. I am a recovering attorney of 27 years and a former representative recovering as well. This is deja vu for me. For 2 years ago, SB 577 was before this very committee, in which I was vice chair, and we heard the same people testify for and against that particular piece of legislation, which was allegedly referred to as a Defense of Marriage Act. HJR 29, in its progeny with its amendments as submitted by Representative Mannix today, I oppose for three basic reasons. It violates Article 1, Section 20 of the Oregon Constitution. It is unnecessary and prohibits, it is unnecessary to prohibit same-sex marriages because we already have a statute that does that. And in conclusion, the third reason, it discriminates against a class of people for no legitimate state reason other than animus. First of all, Article 1, Section 20 of the Oregon Constitution prohibits already the passing of any law that grants to any citizen or class of citizens privileges, etc., as referred to by Mr. Fedanke. To amend the article to, in fact, exclude one class of citizens from its protections would, in effect, nullify the article by cross purposes. You simply nullify Article 1, Section 20, because it has no meaning after that. You have created, in fact, an ambiguity that, in my opinion, the Oregon Supreme Court would declare in and of itself unconstitutional. The Oregon legislature, and many times is referred to in historically, has discriminated, and discriminated in invidious ways. If you all recall my same testimony on the floor when we talked about these various laws, we had anti-miscegenation laws on the books for many years. No interracial marriages were permitted. That was not repealed by this state until 1951, and not repealed by the whole United States until Loving versus Virginia in 1967. Do we really wish to return to those days of discrimination and legally sanctioned prejudices? I would hope not. They are unnecessary, these HCR 29 and its progeny or its amendments thereto. The Oregon statute already says very clearly that a marriage is a contract entered into between a person, a male at least 17, and a female at least 17 years of age. I think that should be increased to 18, but that's neither here nor there. This statute already defines marriage as being a contract between a male and a female. So obviously it should not, it should be amended to increase, as I said, 18. But why should we have to have a state constitutional amendment? What is the reason for doing so when we have this by statute? Regardless of my recommendations, why would we choose to amend our Constitution to discriminate when our present statute already discriminates? Finally, these progeny HDR 29 and its amendments discriminate on their face. These proposed constitutional amendments discriminate against a class of people for no legitimate state reason other than that we exist as a people. We have caused no threat to society. We pay taxes, contribute to the community, raise our children, by which I have two children, both adults, and I raise them in a gay household. We provide jobs, hold elected offices, commit to creating a better society. Our unions have not undermined your marriages. Have any of you who have been divorced ever used the argument that the reason your marriage failed was due to the fact that gay couples lived in a committed relationship? Not once in the 27 years of my practice had I ever heard of a client tell me in a divorce situation, I've got to get divorced because those gay couples are staying together over there. The laws presently discriminate us against us in so many different ways. Do we need more? We do not have automatic inheritance rights. We can't file joint tax returns. There's nothing pending right now in the courts that would do so. Do you really wish to create a rerun of 1988, 92, and 94 when the OCA caused divisiveness among Oregonians? In conclusion, these resolutions will nullify the meaning of our present Constitution and will at the same time deny a class of citizens the rights granted to all others. They are unnecessary since we already have laws defining marriage. And finally, and the most importantly, they will discriminate against a class of people whose alleged crime is that we have chosen to live together in a committed relationship. I assure you, my 18-year relationship with my male partner has done more to solidify the commitments of our truly committed of non-gay married couples than it has to weaken them. If you are truly committed to your statements that you do not wish to discriminate against gays and lesbians, but only wish to preserve the traditional concept of marriage, as I have heard today, then I submit the following amendment. And Chair, I have handed out the amendment.
We have it.
And the amendment basically says that, sure, I will agree that a man and a woman is the only definition of marriage, but at the same time, you must grant to me a contractual obligation that I should get the same rights, privileges, obligations, and responsibilities as if I had entered into a valid marriage. Grant me those. You can define marriage any way you wish. And finally, if marriage is so sacred to you and so serious, two strikes, you're out. No more marriage after you've been divorced two times, if it's so serious to you. Or three strikes, you're out. I don't care. But the fact is, if you're really serious, then be serious about entering into marriage. I thank you very much. I urge your no vote on HDR 29.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Walker, then Representative Werbelow.
Thank you. Mr. Amy, I have a question about your amendment. I like it. I think subsection 3 is kind of amusing. I've only been married once for 24 years, so I wouldn't come under your subsection. But what I'm concerned about is if I take this seriously, which I do, subparagraph 2 under paragraph 1 says in the resolution itself says no provision of this Constitution requires the granting of marriage licenses, rights, or benefits to unmarried individuals. I think that would conflict with your amendment, and your amendment doesn't address that because you talk about giving rights and benefits. So would we have to remove that?
Chair Shetterly and Representative Walker, as a member of this committee, a former member of this committee, I can assure you the Ledge Council will correct it. And I do have a provision in there that says notwithstanding. That's sort of a legal term, catch-all, that says notwithstanding anything else that has been said here, even if I'm in fact conflict with what has been previously said, what follows holds true.
Okay. Just wanted to clear that up.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Werbelow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I think this proposed amendment may have some merits, but I do have to ask this question as to number 3. Are we not setting up a class of people we're discriminating against?
Representative Chatterley and Representative Werbelow, yes, we are. And I just wanted, in response to Representative Walker's comment, it was not intended to be serious other than to point out the foolishness of some people's statements that marriage is entered into for a life commitment. And in fact, there are members on this committee and on the House floor and in the Senate who have been married 3 or more times, and therefore, do they take their marriage seriously? I think they do, but those who have spoken before me have said otherwise.
I don't want a show of hands. Are there members in this committee that have been married?
Not me. I'm a one owner.
Okay, for the record. For the record, there
that
are
that indentured servitude?
Yeah.
Well, he might think so.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have next Doug Vandegrind and Suzanne Cook.
Do I have a stern weller pretty soon?
Hey, we'll get done.
No, I don't.
Is it excuse not to go?
Good afternoon. Thank you for your patience.
Good afternoon. Thank you for yours. My name is Doug Vandegrind. I am the Chief Operating Officer of Western Center for Law and Religious Freedom. We're an Oregon public interest law firm, and I've also been a practicing attorney for about 20 years here in Marion County. I am here to speak in favor of this Resolution 29. Two areas, realizing that I wish to be brief, as I'm sure the committee does, I'd like to discuss. The first is with regard to some of the mechanical legal difficulties that I think exist if this resolution does not pass. It's been said, and I'm not going to argue with it, because I think it's probably true and a little bit more than that, that there's about 210 rights that accrue to a couple when they marry. I'm sure that is true. In addition, what hasn't been said is there are a whole pile of obligations. How many, I'm not sure, but probably about the same number. In other words, marriage is a relationship. in which we are granted rights by the state, the government, and we accept responsibilities by that government. It's probably also fair to say that, fairly stated, the whole law of marriage absolutely infests our legal code, whether it be civil or criminal, in both areas. What we're being asked to do, if we do not pass this resolution, is we're being asked to overturn a wheelbarrow full of all kinds of goodies in both our civil and criminal code without having considered them one by one, without even having considered them by the dozen. I think that is an extremely poor way to create foundational public policy, an extremely poor way to create law. And it will, contrary to what I think opponents suggest to this, it will create a divisiveness as we have never seen in this state. I think the Assistant Attorney General suggested the mail's coming. He was correct. The Department of Revenue taxation issue was only the first of many, many, many issues. Right now, if I'm honest with my clients, I have to tell them that, based on Tanner, any law that includes as one of its elements the status of marriage, I'm not sure whether that's constitutionally in effect anymore. And there is a whole pile of statutes, not to mention probably common law principles, in which the same can be said. Secondly, I get a bit concerned when this is seen either by proponents or opponents as something that comes out of a particular religious perspective. I think in human history, whether you're of a Judeo-Christian perspective, whether you're of a Buddhist perspective, a Hindu perspective, a Darwinian evolutionist perspective, an agnostic perspective, you have to admit that it is the case that on balance, through the entirety of human history, marriage has been regarded, I am sure there are exceptions, marriage has been regarded as a union of one man and one woman. Why? I think the reason why is very instructive. When proponents of same-sex marriage advocate, they have a tendency to point to the relationship between two adults. And there is a relationship between two adults in marriage. However, I think, fairly stated in the concept of marriage, the emphasis is not so much the relationship between two adults, but what that relationship has to do with dependencies. And in fact, dependency, that is children, are an inherent element of a man-woman relationship. That is not an inherent element of a same-sex, quote-quote, marriage. It does not exist. Government deals in broad strokes. Government must, because there is no option, define what the building block institutions of society are. We've heard quite a bit this afternoon about government shouldn't impose this on people. Government shouldn't impose that on people. We may fight to the death about what is right, but you shouldn't impose your beliefs on that. We have an entire criminal and civil code in which the government tells us everything that is in that code, and it's approximately this wide. We do this all the time. We say, you may do this, you may not do that. Those people, you may do this. These people, you may not do that. That is standard fare for government, and this is one of them. So, for example, if the government decides that it may not restrict marriage to one man and one woman, why can it not then also, or if it cannot decide that, what gives it the right to restrict it to people who are parent and child? What gives it the right to restrict it to numbers? If you cannot do those kind of restrictions, you cannot do those kind of restrictions. I think it's a little bit of a red herring to bring up the argument, hey, government, who are we to impose our will on anybody? We must decide what the fundamental societal structures are. One of the most fundamental, in fact, the most fundamental, and I think anybody of any religious persuasion, any religious tradition, on the whole, the most fundamental institution we have in society is family. I think we ought to look at this a little bit more as family, not as marriage. Now, certainly, when you have some same-sex unions, you do get families involved. You may have a divorce, and then there's a later union, so to speak, between same-sex people, and they have dependencies. And I'll grant you this, that sometimes we ought to take a look at the benefits that we give to people and base it more on dependencies rather than upon who it is that you have sex with. Because of the point of marriage, the point of marriage as an institution is it is a protected institution for the rearing of children, our next generation, the next generation after that, and the next generation after that. And if we look at that, and if we look at the government's inherent need to deal with society in broad stroke basis, it makes all the sense in the world why we should define marriage as a relationship between one man and one woman. Just a couple other points briefly.
Okay.
We discussed the Tanner decision, and there's one thing in the Tanner decision that disappointed me greatly, and I discussed this at length with a number of constitutional experts across the country. Usually when a court makes a decision that declares a new class of people to be a suspect class, there is a great deal of opinion that is written to do that. Then, as you know, if we declare something to be a suspect class, then the government must have a compelling reason to discriminate despite the fact that those folks are in a suspect class. In the Tanner decision, we got this. And this was a bombshell for anybody, I think, who seriously looked at that. When considering the question, now, is there any reason to discriminate? They didn't go to any length. They didn't cite any studies. They didn't look at any history. They said, well, the parties didn't tell us about any, and offhand, we can't think of any either. And that was it. With all due respect to the court, I believe this Court of Appeals panel intended to pave a road that would, in fact, outlaw or declare unconstitutional our current marriage statute. And I think it is incredibly incumbent upon this legislature to not that let that happen, and at minimum, as this resolution would do, refer this incredibly fundamental question to our society at large to let them vote on it.
All right, thank you. Thank questions you. From Mr. Vandegrind, Representative Orbelow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two questions. You, your testimony, a lot of it was in terms of the children as part of the structure. My question of you is, do all married people have children?
They don't.
Okay.
And I believe if we had government able to micromanage as opposed to macromanage, we could probably make those distinctions. And sometimes you do make distinctions like insurance benefits and so based on whether you have children or not. But when you're making government policy, you have to necessarily deal at a macro level. And so you have to make some dividing lines, and I wish they could be more precise.
To follow up,
sure.
You know, we've heard that the reason you have a man and woman as the married couple is for procreation and so forth. In your mind, do married couples who don't have children, does that or should it make their marriage invalid since they're not fulfilling their purpose in life?
No, it shouldn't, because you can never say that they're not going to have children, because they always have the capacity. I think my wife and I were married 8 years until we had children. And again, you probably get back to the problem of micromanaging. I mean, some parents can have children. But if you took the statistical study and said, you know, among the same-sex people who are married or you know, live together, and heterosexual, boy, you'd come up with a statistical contrast that would be incredible. So again, government needs to macromanage, not micromanage, and I think that's the reason it's valid for it to do it.
One other question,
sure.
Please. Is it more important in your mind that children be raised by a mother and father than two people of the same sex, even if the mother and father teach hatred, prejudice, discrimination, and the couple of the same sex teach love, respect, honor of each other?
Well, there's obviously a ton of variables that go into any question about where kids are better off. And I think what you're posing is a very false question. I mean,
why is it false?
It's a false question because you're saying of all the possibilities that exist, tell me, are you going to pick A or B? A is being in a really great relationship with what you think is fundamentally wrong, and B is being in a really lousy relationship with what you think is fundamentally right. Of a million scenarios that you can come up with, you come up with an incredible contrast. Maybe they ought to go to the uncle. It would be a simplistic answer to a simplistic question if I said one or the other. I'd have to go look at the family and decide.
But your position was simplistic. You said they belong with a mother and a father. So I'm just following.
No, I didn't actually say
so
that.
So regardless of, well.
I didn't actually say
I'm
that.
I'm not going to argue
okay.
about that.
Thank you.
You said.
Anybody else for Mr. Vandegrind? All right. Ms. Cook.
Thank you. One thing I want to start with is I'm going to be sharing with you things that are very, very difficult, very personal. and this is not the Oprah Winfrey Show. The reason I'm doing this is for a very directed purpose, and I entrust you with myself and my past and my history. I believe homosexual marriage is detrimental to our society, and I have authority to speak on this subject because I was raised in a homosexual home. My father is homosexual. I was 7 years old when I discovered my dad kissing another man at the front door of my house one night. I have barely survived the impact of that pivotal event in my young life. My parents' divorce was final when I was 10, and they had joint custody of my brother and me. At that time, I started smoking cigarettes and drinking alcohol. I started smoking marijuana. And the summer I turned 12, had sexual intercourse. I was arrested for the first time when I was 14 and had overdosed on a combination of prescription drugs. By 15, I was taking LSD after school. I was arrested again for possession of marijuana and LSD. The summer I turned 17, I graduated from high school and I moved in with my boyfriend, who was 22 years older than I. By the time I turned 20, I had 2 abortions. It seems strange to me now, but no one seemed to notice I was having a hard time. I don't have a degree in psychology, but I know the nurturing I needed from my father as a young girl was not there for me. I sought it out early with sexual intercourse, a very sophisticated activity for a 12-year-old. Sex was frightening and painful for me. Even though I knew it was wrong, it seemed to be the only way I knew to get the love I needed. My need for the father figure is clear by my choice of a boyfriend older than my father. Another problem with early sexual activity is it robbed me of my innocence, which ultimately robbed me of my childhood. My dad was unable to fulfill the need I had for safe, non-sexual affection as a little girl. In a healthy father-daughter relationship, a young girl learns the subtleties of getting a man's attention that is developed over time without having sex. My father told me he actually found a woman's body repulsive. My dad was not able to relay approval of my feminine body, and I was uncomfortable with it growing up. Even though my dad found the female body repulsive, he was attracted to men who exhibited female qualities. He also acted in feminine ways through speech, gestures, and clothing. This was upsetting and confusing to me. I didn't understand the line between masculine and feminine and fell into relationships later in life with super masculine Clint Eastwood type men, and some physically abused me. The majority of his friends were homosexual, which impacted my brother and me in different ways. It was dangerous for my brother because he was sexually abused by 2 of my dad's friends, one whom was his lifetime partner. It was uncomfortable for me because I could tell that they didn't like women or children. For instance, when they had a dinner party, the conversation included homosexual sexual innuendo, and it made me extremely uncomfortable as a child. I wanted my dad's adult friends to like me, and I tried to act in ways I thought would be attractive to homosexual men as I grew older. My father tried to show me love in many ways. Because of his homosexuality, he could not communicate his love and approval for me as a girl. In parenting classes, you learn to focus on guiding, directing, and analyzing the needs of your children. Then you go on to create an environment that helps you grow into a healthy adult. Having children is the ultimate sacrifice. I have 1 living child now. A really good parent puts many of their own needs aside or delays fulfilling them until later in life when their children are successfully launched. My dad was too consumed with his own needs, sexual and emotional, to focus on my brother and I. Therefore, when I was exhibiting classic signs of acting out my pain by saturating myself with drugs and alcohol, I was ignored by everyone but the police. From 42 years of experience, I can tell you, even though my parents loved me, their homosexual orientation was a handicap to my ability to learn to relate to life in a healthy way. My homosexual home, by its mere definition, stunted my growth as a person and as a female, not to mention the damaging effect of 16 years of drug and alcohol abuse on my early childhood development. Another distressing part of growing up in a homosexual family was the fact that by the time I was 26 years old, I had the shocking realization that all my values and natural reactions to life were destructive and very self-destructive. At a point of suicide, I started the slow and painful process of reconstructing my life. I had to stop smoking cigarettes, drinking alcohol, getting high, and being sexually promiscuous if I was going to make it. I literally had to relearn how to think, feel, and behave. I felt betrayed by my parents, knowing that for the first 20 years of my life, what came naturally to me would ultimately destroy me. To conclude, I experienced the first 20 years of my life forced into a family that nearly destroyed me, and the last 22 years trying to make sense of it. The bottom line is, I was dearly loved by my parents and my dad's partner. Their love alone was not enough to give me the foundation I needed to grow into a secure young woman. Did my father intend for my life to go this way? No, he did not. He loved me. He loves me still, and I love him. Was he a good father to me as a child? No, he was not, and he has admitted that to me. Did he try to be a good father? Yes, he did, with as much as he could. Was he successful as a father for a young girl? No, he was not. My father and I have looked back through the past and discussed the issue of homosexual parenting. With great remorse, he agrees the homosexual lifestyle, no matter how conservative, is not healthy for children. My father and I agree homosexuality and raising healthy children exclude each other if you put children first. I strongly, as a private citizen, giving you a window into an adult experience after years of being able to analyze my childhood, which is very different from when I was 10, very different analyzing from when I was 18, to please consider giving this bill to the citizens of Oregon to make this decision. Thank you so much.
Ms. Cook, are there any questions? All right, thank you very much. We have next Kurt Mudd and Alan Hodges.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I will make this brief. I'm Kurt Mudd. I'm the Director of Corporate Human Resources for Nike. And Nike asked me to come down south on the 5 to ask the committee to oppose HJR 29. And I'm very business motivated on articulating this point of view with you, and that is this. Nike's competing in a highly competitive global marketplace, and we spend a lot of time and attention and dedicated energy becoming an employer of choice. We feel that our people in our organization, who are citizens of Oregon, are our true competitive advantage to compete in the marketplace. We have done a lot of dedicated work and time creating a corporate culture and a benefits and a philosophy of benefits that support equal access to and for all employees at Nike. By the state of Oregon considering this, it undermines what many employers of Oregon have attempted to do, both in the private and nonprofit sector, of perpetuating equal access to benefits for all employees. So simply put, that's what I want to represent today. And representing Nike, we'd like to recommend that you oppose the HJR 29. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Hodges.
Actually, I'm Alan Hodges. Excuse me. I'm the president of Portland General Operations. I prepared testimony that in part is much like Mr. Mudd's testimony that talks about my corporation, my parent corporation, Enron Corp., and its dependence on intellectual capital. And the dependency to obtain, retract, and retain that intellectual capital to propel us into the next century. Instead, what I'd like to do is talk a little bit in summary about my family. I have learned a lot being in here. I am a proud parent of two daughters. I have a 19-year-old daughter that's a freshman at University of Texas at Austin, and I have a 16-year-old student at St. Mary's Academy. I am a gay parent. I am a primary custodian of my children. I do not think that parenting is the ultimate sacrifice. I think that parenting is the ultimate right. I feel honored and respected to have two children, to be able to be in a situation to provide love and support for my children. It is not related to me being a gay man, being a good parent. It is not related to how I choose to bring up my children. I'm a proud parent of those, and I would stress to you that an appropriate family, a committed resource, is and partner is critical to providing the good background for children in a relationship. So I would like to present a positive role model of children, not only from the parenting standpoint and about the love and joy and respect that I get, but that the opportunities that I provide for my children as well, and the degree of seriousness which I take childbearing, child support. I'd also like to talk a little bit about my past experience, and I'm lucky now that I work for Enron. I wasn't always in the same position. Enron provides same-sex benefits to partners. My previous partner, Jeff, was diagnosed HIV positive 8 years ago. He was in the educational system, and unfortunately, a component of his health care was that after he was declared disabled, he had insurance benefits for 18 months following that. In short, had I been able to provide Jeff with health care benefits at that point, my committed partner of a long term, is Jeff would have been able to work up until the point that he was physically comfortable and emotionally capable to work. Instead, we were forced in a situation where we were required to project and predict what his own mortality would be. Imagine the difficulty I faced with a partner in a declining health care situation and him being forced to work up until the point to where you felt that his life would be terminated within an 18-month window. It's a difficult decision. I'm fortunate now that I do have benefits in the private sector. I would urge you to consider HJR 29 and to oppose this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hodges. Is there any questions for Mr. Hodges? All right, thank you both for coming forward. We have one remaining panel, Diane Walter, Reverend Dick Burden, and Reverend Priscilla Walters. And I think the ultimate thanks for patience goes to you folks.
I would say so.
Yes. I'm sorry we can't all go first.
Well, it's been educational today for me.
I'm sure.
And I also have Mr. Backlund, who's not here anymore, as a history teacher back in high school.
Oh.
So both of my kids, so I was going to rouse him a little. My name is Diane Walter, Mr. Chairman, and the committee members that are left. Mine's very brief. I am in a union of a marriage with a husband, and I have two children, and one is heterosexual and one is gay. My boy, my daughter, is heterosexual. Neither chose their sexual orientation, as I didn't choose mine either. You're just born that way. And I guess I just want to make the issue that I really want the same things for my son as he grows up. He's 19, he's in college, as my daughter will have. And that's it.
Thank you. Questions from the voters?
No, Mr., but I have a comment. It is so, I guess the word's neat, I don't know, wonderful to have a parent here, and we've had several here supporting their children. We've had letters and so forth. And a lot of times children don't have the support of their parents, so I really appreciate
it. Well, it doesn't take very much. My son actually talked to me when he was 12, and when people say you choose the lifestyle, they just don't understand. You do not choose the lifestyle at age 12. And I've been fortunate to talk to Mr. Backlund about it, who did not know, and he had both my kids in his class. And he says, well, I've learned a lot about your family now. And I said, yeah, you do. You have. So I'll probably continue to talk to him a little further.
Okay. Reverend Burden.
Chairman Shetterly and members of the committee, I'm Richard Burden. I'm a retired clergy member of the Oregon-Idaho Conference of the United Methodist Church, and I keep my activity in the church in North Portland, University Park. It is a reconciling congregation, and I've given a description of that in my written testimony as to what that is. And I have also given a longer version of, including a lot of detail with regard to where our church is and other backgrounds that you might find interesting and informative. My testimony is against the HDR 29. My life and affiliation with the church may suggest my interest in this proposed measure. that I do not come here to speak on behalf of the United Methodist Church or any of its agencies, but I do appear here to, and I do not appear here today to discuss my religious views regarding homosexuality. But I am here to oppose the proposition that is before us, which seeks to deny the civil rights of a minority of the residents of the state of Oregon. I find it inept, harmful, and generally litigious to generate laws which are based on inference and not fact, which can void civil rights guarantees by popular vote. It strikes me as illogical to accuse same-sex relationships of threatening the status of opposite-sex partnerships. How can legal same-sex unions damage families? Many of my gay and lesbian friends have established long-term relationships, households, and families. At the 1990 International Association of Gay Square Dance Clubs convention in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, two men celebrated their 40th anniversary of life together. That was a very great celebration. And they are still together and will be dancing at the 16th annual convention in Los Angeles at the Bonaventure, Westin Bonaventure Hotel over the July weekend, and I plan to be there. In December, the Rosetown Ramblers, a Portland gay lesbian square dance group that I've been associated with for over 16 years, celebrated the arrival of a child to a lesbian couple. We gave a shower for the new baby, and that festive occasion drew about 20 of our members. We all enjoyed the couple opening presents for the baby. And then the dads and the moms in our groups put together a little swing given to the baby. We took turns holding that child. It looked like a family gathering to me. All but about five present had been married and have children. We cherish and love our children. We were heartbroken when we realized that we could not continue in that traditional family lifestyle. We had to establish new friendships and new circles of friends. Our friends had become our families. Families are formed in diverse ways. Some are traditional, some are not. These homes are intentionally formed where love prevails. These families need the support and the protection of the state of Oregon. And this mysterious we passage is a personal testimony that I was married for 25 years and had two children. One daughter who is now working on her doctoral in mathematics, and a son who is now a professional musician. We celebrate together special days like anniversary or like birthdays and other Christmas and Thanksgiving, when oftentimes I cook the dinner. I thank you for this opportunity to speak with you today, and I ask for your vote against HGR 29, for I think that HGR cloaks itself in language that sounds normal or noble, but the effect of this measure, however, is to reintroduce, recreate, and validate imposing illegal status on a particular group of people. The court has said this is illegal. I believe it is unfair and unjust for the state of Oregon to grant the majority access to rights, but deny them to the minority of the people. I perceive that the intent of this proposed measure is to deny sexual minority persons justice and protect
protection of their civil rights. Such an objective is intended to intimidate and silence voices that have been raised to demand justice and equality. I believe it is in order for the state of Oregon to provide for legal avenues to honor, recognize, and protect personal property, and provide access for personal care of all committed partnerships, whether they be same-sex or opposite-sex. HDR seeks to reject these objectives and rights. I do not support what the measure seeks to do. I hope you will not either. I ask for your vote against HDR 29.
Okay, thank you, Reverend Burton. Any questions? Comments? Okay, thank you. Reverend Walters.
I want to say good late afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is B.D. Walters, and I have been an ordained clergy person in the United Methodist Church for 20 years. Before sharing with you my two-minute testimony, I want to share what I believe is good news. The God of the Judeo-Christian tradition, about whom we have been speaking all afternoon, was best known perhaps for releasing the captives. And I think in 2 minutes that may occur again.
And we shall rejoice.
For the past 4 years, I have been the pastor at University Park United Methodist Church. We are a widely diverse congregation. In addition to heterosexual people of all ages, our membership includes gay and lesbian individuals and couples. We have worshipped, laughed, worked, argued, sorrowed, and celebrated together as we have comprised to be a seeking and searching community of faith. In very real ways, we are all family for one another, and therefore we are deeply concerned about any laws, practices, or prejudices which diminish the well-being of any of us. Therefore, I come before you out of my pastoral experience strongly opposing any bill which would overturn the Tanner decision giving domestic partners of same-sex couples access to the health care benefits afforded to married couples and which married couples take for granted. I'd like to close by telling you two stories. There are in my congregation two women who have been partners for over 16 years. They are also sisters and daughters, a mother and a grandmother, an aunt and a great aunt, with a whole host of extended kin. Like almost all middle-aged couples, they wrestle with finances, fair division of household tasks, the care of frail parents, and worries over whichever family member is currently experiencing one of life's sorrows. However, unlike most middle-aged couples, they now wrestle with a far more permanent stress. A year and a half ago, one of them had a major stroke which marked the end of her professional career. Subsequently, in response to her need for physical assistance and emotional support, her self-employed partner has greatly curtailed her own work schedule. As a result of this medical crisis, the family's income was quickly decreased significantly. Sadly, such crises do happen, and we all know that. But what does not happen to most couples, and what is grossly unfair, is that the diabetic partner of the woman who had the stroke, deprived of domestic partnership health care coverage and being unable to afford private pay treatment, has for years subjected her own physical and mental well-being to compromise. Another couple in our congregation has similarly faced financial diminished status because one of the partners has gone back to school in order to retool as a result of continued employment discrimination due to her orientation. Last month, this woman was diagnosed with a problematic gallbladder, and she learned that the periodic bouts of acute abdominal pain which she has been experiencing signaled the necessity for gallbladder surgery. However, because she's not eligible for medical insurance coverage under her partner's plan, she's currently postponing this procedure. And she is literally living from attack to attack on painkillers until she can finish the spring term, seek employment, and gain insurance for herself. In my experience as a clergy person, domestic partners of same-sex couples are parents helping with homework, our caregivers looking after aged loved ones, our community volunteers along with youth and neighborhood associations. They labor with their beloved companions in life to create, nurture, and sustain strong, vibrant families. Consequently, domestic partners need and should be, by law, entitled to the same benefits and security that heterosexual spouses receive. If we in Oregon truly value families as we so proclaim, we will defeat this measure, a measure that allows for the continuance of unfair discrimination against a large number of our vibrant and strong families. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions, Representative Werbelow?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Not a question, but just a comment. And I have thought about this and thought, well, am I here to testify or not? But I think we bring, although we're supposed to be neutral fact finders, perhaps, we also bring our own, I think, our values. And the one thing that I heard today from so many people was about family and the correct role models for young people. But what I didn't hear spoken to was the high rate of suicides and attempted suicides in our young people in Oregon, higher almost than any other state. And many of those young people are people who are just getting into the formative years of their sexuality and so forth. And we, what kind of message are we sending with something like this bill? Are we saying you have no value? And I think all of us, I don't care who we are, whether we're for or against it, that should be the utmost question in our mind. So.
All right. I think that signals the end, the moment of deliverance. Is that what you...
release from the captives.
The release for the captives. Okay. I do want to thank those of you who stuck around to the end, and committee members especially. I apologize to some of our committee members were not able to stay. We did run about 2.5 hours over our regularly scheduled time, so some of them just had other scheduled commitments to get.
Are we going to have a work session?
Not now, we're not.
Just checking.
Yeah. With that, then, we will conclude the session on HJR 29. Thank everybody for being in attendance today, and thank the committee members for their hard work. We are adjourned.